1 Samuel chapter 17. Let me recap a little. We saw in chapter 14 how Jonathan initiated an attack against the Philistines, and things went very well until Saul jumped into the act and more or less took charge of what God was doing. He decided that he knew what was best to be done. He didn't even bother to ask God. He just went ahead and made his own rules and got people into trouble because he cursed. He said there would be a curse on anyone who ate anything. So the result was that people were starving, they were hungry, they were weak, they were faint, and there wasn't such a decisive victory. And Jonathan said in chapter 14, verse 29, "My father has troubled the land. Look now how my countenance has brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they found. For now would there not have been a much greater slaughter among the Philistines." So it was a truncated victory. And now we find the consequences of that truncated victory in verse 1 of chapter 17. "Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle, and were gathered together at Soko, which belongs to Judah. They encamped between Soko and Azekah in Ephes Damim." If there had been that decisive victory, there wouldn't have been that comeback. And that for us is an important lesson, that when we seek to do something for God, let's do it. Let's do it thoroughly. Let's not indulge in half-baked remedies. Let's not do things half-heartedly, because what will happen is the consequences of our half-hearted actions will return to haunt us. And we will find that if we have not fought our battle decisively and won the victory in certain areas of our lives, that those weaknesses that we have not dealt with will come back and torment us and haunt us and give us more trouble. It's harder to deal with a problem the second time than it is to deal with it once and for all. Now I'm saying this, but remember what was the cause of this poor victory, of this truncated victory. The cause of it was that Saul did not ask God's guidance. What we can use for our comfort and encouragement is when we ask God, "What do you want me to do? How do you want me to deal with this situation in my life or with this area in my experience?" When we consult God, He will show us what to do, and He will be right in there with us to help us and to rescue us and to clean the whole thing up so that you won't need a second battle. There won't be another conflict to follow. When you bring God into your situation, into your problem, and you allow Him to guide you and to help you to deal with it, you won't have it bothering you again. It may come nagging at your door, but you'll never have to fight that same battle again. Here we see the consequence of Saul's rashness. The Philistines, they were able to get away, and so they lived to fight another day. As they say, he who fights and runs away lives to fight another day. And that's what was true about the Philistines. Let's read verse 1, verse 2 to 5. "And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines, named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. The Philistines were seeking to avenge their former defeat. Following the botched battle in chapter 14, they were in a position to make a comeback. And Goliath, this man, was 9 feet 6 inches tall. His coat of mail weighed 125 pounds. The head of his spear weighed 15 pounds. He was probably from the remnant of those giants that we read about, like Og, king of Bashan, whom Moses conquered on the other side of Jordan. There were still a few giants left. There is a ridiculous legend in the Talmud, I think, which says that Og was one of the giants who escaped the flood. He was so tall that even when the waters of the flood covered the tops of the mountains, he was still able to keep his chin above the water. Foolish. No wonder the Bible tells us not to give heed to fables. Now, this man was probably about the same height as Goliath. Goliath, 9 feet 6 inches tall. And look at the psychological warfare that he uses here. Verse 8. He stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? What business have you got daring to fight with us? Am I not a Philistine and you the servants of Saul?" I am the Philistine. This is what the Bible calls the pride of the Philistines, pride of race. I am a Philistine. You are the slaves of Saul. Then he says, "Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me, if he is able to fight with me." See the language used there? "And kill me, then we will be your servants. But if not, if I am able to prevail, but if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." It was sheer, straight intimidation. And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." He was determined, he was absolutely sure of victory. For 40 days, day and night, he came, and every time the people of Israel said, "Come on, let's fight," they drew up their battle lines, he'd step forward and everybody would quail and shrink and draw back. Verse 11, when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David had gone back, so he didn't hear this challenge. Verse 15, but David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. And the people of Israel knew it was only a matter of time before they'd have to fight. And then they knew, or they thought they knew, it was all over. It was at this point that Jesse told David to go and find out how his brothers were doing. Nowadays in the army, everything's laid on, even Coca-Cola for the troops out at the front. But in those days, much of the supplies for the troops came not only from the leaders of the army, but from the relatives and the families back home. And that's why Jesse said to his son David, "Go and see how your brothers are doing. See if they've got enough to eat. See how their captain is doing. Send some food for him as well." Verse 17, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves, and run to your brothers at the camp, and carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000. They were in what you would call a regiment. So David arose early in the morning, verse 20, left the sheep with the keeper, and there we see a glimpse of David's character, that he was a shepherd at heart. There are several people whom God used for his people, for Israel, and they were all shepherds. Perhaps you can think of a few. Moses was, Joseph was. We have David here. There was the prophet Amos. He was a shepherd. And perhaps you can think of others as well. But most of all, our Messiah, when he says in Zechariah, "Man taught me to keep cattle from my youth." What he meant was, I grew up looking after the sheep. Well, David arose in the morning, went to see his brothers, and as he came into the battle lines, they were drawing up as usual for battle. And at that moment, Goliath stepped forward and issued his challenge. David was a newcomer to the scene, and we read that when he heard this challenge, he was flabbergasted. He was amazed. It wasn't that he was afraid. He was just amazed that people were afraid of Goliath. Verse 25. So the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches, will give him his daughter, and give his father's house exemption in Israel." Then David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" He couldn't believe that there was such a big reward for such a small thing. To him, looking with God's eyes, it wasn't such a big problem. You see how our problems look to us when we look on them with God's eyes. And the people answered him, told him the same thing again, "So shall it be done for the man who kills him." At this point, his older brother blew up, said, "You're just nothing but a show-off." But David said, "It's incredible. This reward is out of all proportion to what is required." Well, Saul heard about it, and we know the story of how Saul tried to don his armor on David, and David said, "I can't go in this. I haven't had a chance to prove it." Took it all off, took 5 stones in his pouch, and went out to meet Goliath. He assured Saul he could do it. He said in verse 36, "Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." So he went, and the Philistine, verse 42, when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him. He was looking for someone, chain armor maybe, clank, clank, thud, thud, making his ponderous way across the valley to meet him. Instead, he sees a young man with just a sling and shepherd's pouch, pretty looking young boy, just a little fuzz on his cheeks perhaps for growing beard. He was but a youth, ruddy and good looking. So the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Well, David's response was, verse 46, "This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you." And as the Philistine came to meet David, David hastened to and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. Then David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone, and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead, so that the stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the earth. In the 6-day war, when Israel managed to push back those armies from 5 countries, in 6 days, there was a scream of protest afterwards from the defeated countries. And a humorist called Ephraim Kishon, who wrote, whose articles appeared regularly in the Jerusalem Post had a derisive article called "Unfair to Goliath." How dare you, says anti-USA. Anti-USA says to her niece Israel, how dare you win a battle? I've been in Vietnam for many years and I haven't won yet. You should have taken a little longer about winning the war, etc. It was quite a derisive article. But it's also pathetic to find what liberal theologians write about this. It's quite pathetic. They say, how cunning David was. My goodness, there's nothing cunning about it. David had his sling in his hand. He said, I'm going to hit you. I'm going to smite you. There's nothing cunning about it. The Philistine knew exactly what kinds of weapons David had in his hand. Sticks and a sling. And so the result was David did kill Goliath, did behead him. The Israelites chased the Philistines, verse 52, and this time they finished off what Saul should have finished. But it needed a new ingredient. It needed a man of faith to come in to remedy the botched up victory of Saul. Do you know what happens sometimes, what God does in His grace? We find that we have not dealt with a certain problem area in our lives that's come back to haunt us, and we don't have the courage to face it again. What does God do? He sends someone completely outside the scene. He sends someone who's got a living faith in God, who comes right in and stands with us, and with their faith and their courage, they help us to overcome. God sends us a brother or a sister or a helper or a prayer partner or a friend or a relative, someone who has faith, and between the two of us, we're able to do it. That's what happened here. David rescued, he redeemed Saul's bad, botched up victory. Verse 54, and David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. I want to read to you a story, a real story written by Richard Harvey. Richard Harvey was a great preacher. His picture's at the back of this book. He tells a story of what happened when he was at a university in the States. He said the most popular class at university was the first year chemistry class. It was definitely the largest. Most every student took the class sometime during his 4 years, regardless of his major. But since it was a first year subject, most took it their freshman year. Dr. Lee was the most noted and honored professor in the college. He had had many honors bestowed on him from numerous scientific societies around the world. His influence carried more weight than that of any of the other teachers. He insisted that he believed in God as the creator of an original mass that was thrown into space, and that God had set a group of laws to govern it. In other words, he just wound up the clock and let it run and quit. He also believed that God no longer paid any special attention to the earth as far as man was concerned. He believed it was useless for man to try to get God's attention, much less his intervention. Among many involved themes in his lectures, Dr. Lee chose the subject of prayer. A series of 3 lectures given annually the week before the Thanksgiving recess. The second lecture emphasized the thought that there was no such thing as a miracle. After that class, when some of the students were gathered around him, I said, Dr. Lee, I have proof of a miracle. He went on to recount how the man was miraculously cured when his vocal cords had been destroyed by mustard gas in World War I. His reply was, I don't believe in any such thing. It must have some scientific explanation. His third lecture was on the subject of the impossibility of an objective answer to prayer. He said he would prove it. At the end of the lecture, he announced that he would step down from his platform onto the concrete floor. Then he would challenge, "Is there anybody here who still believes in prayer?" Just like Goliath. And he would say, "Before you answer, let me tell you what I'm going to do and what I'm going to ask you to do. I will turn around, take a glass flask, and hold it at arm's length." Then he would continue, "If you believe that God answers prayer, I want you to stand and pray that when I drop this flask, it won't break. I want you to know that your prayers and the prayers of your parents and Sunday school teachers and even the prayers of your own pastor cannot prevent this flask from breaking. If you wish to have them here, we will put this off until you return after the Thanksgiving recess." No one had ever accepted Dr. Lee's challenge. But one year, certain freshmen came on the scene. He learned about Dr. Lee's dare. He went up and down the campus. "Do you know anybody who believes in prayer?" "Yeah, there's this guy called Harvey. He's in his senior year," they said. So he went to Harvey and he knocked on his door. He said, "Are you Harvey?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Listen, I want to take Dr. Lee's dare. Will you pray with me every time you think of me and of Dr. Lee? Will you please pray that the flask won't break because I'm going to take his dare?" So they made a pact between them that they would agree together the flask would not break. And then we read, the day came. At the end of the final lecture on prayer, the annual challenge was put forth as it had been for 12 years. As soon as Dr. Lee asked, "Is there anyone here who believes God answers prayer?" the young man stepped into the aisle and raised his hand and said, "Dr. Lee, I do." "Well, this is most interesting. But young man, you had better let me explain what I'm going to do, and then we'll see if you still desire to pray. I wouldn't want you to be embarrassed before this class." The professor then took the glass flask and held it out in front of him over the cement floor. "Now I ask you to pray, if you still want to do it, that this flask won't break. After you pray, I'll drop it. And I can assure you that it will hit the cement floor and break into hundreds of pieces, and that no prayer can prevent it. Do you still want to pray?" "Yes, Dr. Lee, I do." "Well," said the professor, "this is most interesting." And turning to the class, he said sarcastically, "Now we will be most reverent while this young man prays." Then he turned to the young man, "Now you may pray." The freshman just lifted his countenance toward heaven and prayed, "God, I know that you hear me. Please honor the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, and honor me, your servant. Don't let the flask break. Amen." Dr. Lee stretched out his arm as far as he could, opened his hand, and let the flask fall. It fell in an arc, hit the toe of Dr. Lee's shoe, rolled over, and did not break. There was no movement of air. There were no open windows. The class whistled, clapped, and shouted. And Dr. Lee ceased his annual lectures against prayer. Well, doesn't that remind you of David and Goliath? He was like a Goliath, but God answered the prayers of this young man who took his faith in his hands, who had the courage to do what others didn't. And Harvey said later on, he was so ashamed that he didn't have the faith and the courage to do that himself. It's essential that two or three, the Lord Yeshua said, if two or three of you are agreed, it shall be done. So that's what we can do. Have you got something that you're struggling with? Something that's like a giant that's threatening you and you don't know how you're going to deal with it? Get someone else and agree with prayer with that person. A soulmate, a prayer partner, someone who understands, someone who shares your own wishes. All right. So we come back to 1 Samuel 17. See, so the story of David and Goliath repeated itself. And that was in the early 20th century that this happened. Verse 55 of chapter 17. Now when Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" How strange that Saul didn't seem to know. He seemed to know who David was. He doesn't say, "Who is this youth?" But he says, "Whose son is this youth?" The puzzle is, why did he want to know? And the answer, of course, is because of the offer he had made. Remember, in verse 25, the man who kills Goliath, the king will enrich with great riches, will give him his daughter and give his father's house exemption in Israel. That would probably be tax exemption or something like that. Free, the key to the city, freedom of the city, something, whatever it meant. Whose son is this youth? And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." So as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Saul, in verse 58, said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." And as he spoke, as he struck a spark in the heart of a man that had a kindred spirit, the son of Saul, Jonathan. Jonathan was that type of person who was ready to risk his life for God, who was a man of faith and who was willing to go out and do battle against superior forces. And so we read in verse 1 of chapter 18, "It was so when he had finished speaking to Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul." And he also honored David. Verse 4. "Jonathan took off the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, even to his sword and his bow and his belt." Here was David now in great honor. And of course, he was going to be son-in-law to the king, so he could come into the succession. He would then be eligible to be a member of the royal family and also to inherit the throne if Saul had no heirs. But then things go wrong. And we see here how the devil will always try and come in and discourage us after a great victory in our lives. They just had a great victory, but many times when we've had a great victory, that's not the time to say, "Well, I can let my sword drop now from my hand, or I can lower the point of my sword, I can start unbuckling my armor." No, that's a time to keep it on, because the devil never likes it when you poke him in the eye, or when you hit him in the nose. And he's sure to come from behind when you're not looking and trip you up, or make things difficult for you. So just keep up your vigilance. We read in verse 8, "Now it had happened as they were coming home, when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women had come out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul, with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments." It was the custom when people returned from a victory, the women went out to meet them and to dance them into the city with songs and with dances. And those women were very wise. They were very perceptive. The women sang as they danced and said, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. They were quite right. They were very perceptive. But it didn't make Saul happy. Then Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him. And he said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but 1,000. Now what more can he have but the kingdom?" So Saul eyed David from that day forward. And when the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul, as David tried to soothe Saul, we see how Saul, verse 11, cast the spear. He tried to kill David twice. Then came that was the beginning of David's distressing experiences of persecution. Saul, from then on, became more and more the enemy of David. Verse 13, therefore Saul removed him from his presence and made him his captain over 1,000. He demoted him, and he went out and came in before the people. But David wasn't looking for grandeur. That's really what saved David. He wasn't looking for a high position. John Bunyan, in Pilgrim's Progress, has the shepherd boy singing a little song. Shepherd boy in the valley of humiliation. It was a valley that the Christian, as he is called, and who represents the believer, found very difficult to descend into. The descent was steep, and he fell many times before he got at last into the valley of humiliation. But there it was peace. And there was a shepherd boy singing, he that is down need fear no fall, he that is low no pride. David was a humble man, so it didn't bother his pride at all that Saul said, okay, you can't be up there, you just got to be in charge of 1,000. Didn't bother him at all. He just thought it was a privilege to be able to serve in the army. Verse 14, and David behaved wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. The people loved him, verse 16, because he went out and came in before them. He wasn't after any earthly grandeur. He just wanted to serve God. That's what will save you and me many times. When people think that they're going to rub our nose in the dirt, they find that it doesn't bother us at all, the things that they say, the things that they do, because we're not after earthly grandeur. This isn't our home. It's like the traveler who's going home, and on the way there's a shower, an unexpected shower, and he hasn't got his raincoat with him. He's getting a little bit wet, he's a little bit clammy and cold. He says, that's okay, I'll soon be home. I'll be able to get these wet clothes off. So when people throw cold water on you, say, that's okay, I'll soon be home and I'll be able to get these wet clothes off. See, they try and niggle the believer. They try and annoy the believer by using the same kind of taunts that a worldly person would react very violently to. But the believer has his priorities elsewhere. And so all these taunts, they evaporate into, they just fall in, they go into thin air. They just fall to the ground. Well, Saul broke his promise. Verse 17, then Saul said to David, here's my older daughter Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. Verse 18, so David said to Saul, who am I? And what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be son-in-law to the king? I don't really want to aspire to that exalted position. I'm just a shepherd boy. Verse 19, but it happened at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, as a wife. That was meant as a snub, but because David didn't really set his heart on this thing, didn't make any difference to him. What a lesson! What an example! And then Saul found out that his younger daughter had a crush on David. Verse 20, now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. So Saul said, I will give her to him, that she may be a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. He tried other ways, Saul tried other ways. Talk to David, he said to his servants. Talk to him quietly, in private, and say, why don't you become the king's son-in-law? The aim was to accuse David of trying to get the throne in a sneaky way. Because you marry into the king's family, then you've got a claim on the throne. And in that part of the world, that was the stratagem that was often used by people, political alliances, convenience marriages, in order to lay claim on the throne. The king of Spain married his daughter off to the king of England, so that he would have a claim on the throne of England. That's the kind of thing that went on then, and also at the time of Saul. And David said to the people, verse 23, does it seem to you a light thing to be a king's son-in-law, seeing I'm a poor and lightly esteemed man? No way, no way. You've got to be out of your mind to think that I would reach to such great heights. Later on, in one of his psalms, David says, my eyes are not, my heart is not haughty, my eyes are not lifted up, neither do I exercise myself in things too high for me. He's always very careful to keep to his own level. And then Saul said, okay, I want you to kill 100 Philistines. And we have that story from verse 25 onwards. So David went and killed 200 Philistines. And the result was, Saul had no more excuse. He had to give Michal to be his wife. Then verse 30. Then the princes of the Philistines went out to war. And so it was, whenever they went out, that David behaved more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name became highly esteemed. But in chapter 19, it reached a climax. Saul's hatred, Saul's jealousy, aggravated by this distressing spirit that God had sent against him. Chapter 19, verse 1 to 3. Now Saul spoke to Jonathan his son, and to all his servants, that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, my father seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning, and stay in a secret place and hide. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. Then what I observe, I will tell you. Well, it worked. For a time. Jonathan went out and talked to his father the next morning, and he said, how come you want to kill David when he risked his life to save us from Goliath and from the Philistines? And Saul swore, verse 6, as the Lord lives, he shall not be killed. Now, there we see Saul up and down, making resolves and breaking them. Because, verse 9, the distressing spirit from the Lord came upon Saul, and Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear. Then he sent messengers to David's house to arrest David. Verse 11. Saul also sent messengers to David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning. There's one of the Psalms that describes this. He speaks about people watching him day and night, watching his house. He calls them dogs. He describes them like wild dogs that are after his life. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. And then she said, he's sick. She put this thing in the bed. Maybe it was an oversized doll. Like an oversized doll. Saul said, bring him down with the bed. Because in those days, the beds were just quilts or mattresses. And it was quite easy to carry people, like those four men who let down their paralyzed friend through the roof on his bed. And when they came in to grab him, there was the image in the bed with a cover of goat's hair for his head. Then Saul said to Michal, "Why have you deceived me like this and sent my enemy away so that he has escaped?" And Michal answered Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill you?'" That's not true either. But that's another example of how people do sometimes tell lies in order to escape the pressure. We were discussing this on Thursday evening. Is it ever right to tell a lie? It's very difficult to know the answer to that one. People hid Jews from the Nazis in the Second World War. And when they were asked, "Have you got any Jews in your house?" they said, "No." It's a big problem, isn't it? Anyway, she rescued her husband. David went to the one man he knew who could help him. He couldn't get to Jonathan anymore without tangling with Saul, so he went to Samuel. Verse 18. So David fled and escaped and went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and stayed in Naioth. So Saul sent out soldiers to arrest David. But it's a very interesting thing happened. Verse 20. Then Saul sent messengers to take David, and when they saw the group of prophets prophesying and Samuel standing as leader over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. It happened three times. And then Saul went himself, and it happened to him as well. What it tells us is this, that the Holy Spirit will even operate on unsaved people. And the gifts of the Spirit in themselves are no conclusive proof that the person is born again. Balaam prophesied as the Spirit of God made him. Judas cast out demons. He was able to raise the dead. He cleansed the lepers in Yeshua's name. But he was by no means a child of God. So we see the Holy Spirit will use people who are, even those who are not saved. And therefore, if anyone says, "But I've got to be saved, because I've got this gift, I've got that gift, I can prophesy, or I can speak in tongues, or I can heal." The Lord Yeshua said, "Many will come to me in the last day and will say to me, 'Lord, we have done many wonderful works.' And then I will have to say, 'I never knew you.'" So it needs more than that. What are the indisputable marks of a child of God? Three things: faith, hope, and love. Very simple. True faith, a living hope, and a love for God. If you have those three things, those are the indispensable marks of every true believer. Very simple, and you can soon find out if you've got those things in your heart, you're home free. You don't have to go through an internal inquisition. Am I saved? Am I not saved? Do I really believe in the Lord Yeshua? Is he my personal Savior? Do I hope in his return? Do I love him? Do I love his people? Then without a doubt, I'm a child of God. Very simple. But Saul did not have